Hey, everybody, thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Preacher Boys podcast. I make this show for you, and I hope that you really enjoy it. I have a lot of people that ask me how they can support the show financially, and you can do that by heading over to patreon.com/preacherboys. You're going to get access to exclusive content, including early releases of episodes. I've got a couple episodes right now that have been released at least a month early over on Patreon. You've got access to things like unique merch, depending on what tier you join, and you get access to some behind the scenes content that I'm posting within the group. So head over to patreon.com/preacherboys and become a member over there today. Every single supporter helps make this show a little bit more possible, especially as I continue to add additional episodes and content every single week. Thank you so much for tuning in. Let's get back to the show.
Trigger warning. This podcast contains descriptions of various abusive situations. Listener discretion is advised. You are listening to the Preacher Boys podcast, a podcast shedding light on decades of mental, physical, and sexual abuse within the independent fundamental Baptist movement. The testimonies shared on this podcast are told from the personal experience and perspective of the survivors. Not all legal outcomes are known or final. Any suspect is presumed innocent until proven guilty in the court of law. To find more information about the Preacher Boys podcast and upcoming documentary, visit PreacherBoysDoc.com or connect on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the handle @PreacherBoysDoc. Now, here is your host, Eric Skwarzynski.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another episode of the Preacher Boys podcast. I'm so excited to have James here on the show with me. James, can you just really introduce yourself and let my listeners know just how you got introduced to the IFB movement?
All right. So we're going to be here for a couple minutes or a couple hours.
Hopefully not too far into the latter, but.
I'm James Kleinitz. I'm the pastor of Freedom Baptist Church in Dundalk, Maryland. That's the outskirts of Baltimore. We're not an independent fundamental Baptist church. We are a Baptist church, but and we are independent, but I don't call us independent fundamental Baptist church on purpose. I really got introduced to the more cultic section of the independent fundamental Baptist when I was at Hiles Anderson.
It's your choice. Will you choose to be the one? For 39 years, Hiles Anderson College has been training men and women to do just that, to be the one. Purpose, passion, and commitment are the core values of Hiles Anderson College.
It's kind of funny how I ended up there. My youth pastor was completely against Hiles Anderson, so I ended up going there out of rebellion against my youth pastor. And that's how I ended up there. Ended up graduate. Go ahead.
How did that work? Usually it's rebellion to not go to Hiles Anderson. So how did you end up there as an act of rebellion?
My church was completely anti-Hiles Anderson. They were on the Bob Jones side. They were on the Ambassador Baptist Bible College side. They were all in that wheelhouse. So and they thought the music at Hiles Anderson was really, really liberal. So they're in some cases, they were even farther to the extreme. But so I went to a youth conference a couple of times there. I liked the place. I liked the energy. You know, people mm-hmm. seemed excited. People yeah. seemed hyped. So I was like, oh man, this is a place I want to go. So I'm kind of a hyper guy, if you know me, and kind of an upbeat guy. So I kind of want to go place where there's some hyper action going on. So that's how I ended up rebelling against my youth pastor and ending up at Hiles Anderson in spite of his many, many protests against it. So, yeah.
Interesting. What was that like? Because I know, I mean, obviously it was a little bit different environment, but what was it like kind of arriving there and like getting into the Hiles Anderson culture, as it were? Like, what was the college experience like there?
You know, I adapted pretty well. I had a good roommates, and some of my roommates are even still my friends today. I never really had a bad roommate my entire time when I was there. So that really affected a whole lot. I did have to hide a lot of who I was. And for example, I've never really been King James only. Right. So of course, Hiles Anderson, if you even breathe the NIV in your sleep, you're going to get expelled. So, I thought I adapted pretty well. I ended up becoming a bus captain there after a year, and you know, just pretty much flew with the radar and did what they asked me to do, and didn't really complain too much. I noticed a couple things that were really off, like when I was in chapel one time, and one of the leadership, I don't want to mention his name, but he gets up and someone gets up our freshman year and says, well, what if we want to know why we have to obey these rules? And the guy said, well, you don't need to ask questions, just do it and you'll understand later. Of course, that's the textbook cult answer. So right. Those things popped up in my mind, but I didn't really see an issue to cause many problems. I did complain a couple times about my education, and I have since then, to where I didn't learn a whole lot from college. Yeah. Hermeneutics lacked greatly. In fact, I remember a time, I tell people this story. I was sitting in the class, and if I said the teacher's name, everyone would know who it is. I'm not going to say it because I don't want to embarrass the guy, because he's still a friend of mine. But we were sitting in class, and we had to write a paper on the doctrine of the Holy Spirit. And I'm like, I'm going to go complete out on this paper. And I went all out. References and titles and subpoints and all that kind of thing. And I spent hours on this paper. Turned it in, got an A+. Well, I noticed my neighbor, my person sitting next to me, a really good friend of mine even today, gets a paper back. He forgot to do the report until the day of. So he prints out a paper, says, I don't believe in this doctrine, turns it in with a cover sheet. He gets an A+ on it as well. And I was like, what? Obviously, the professor didn't read anything. He just wrote 100% if he did the paper. So that's the education was really, really lacking. But they did teach you how to work. So I can't complain about that. They taught the importance of laboring for the ministry and doing things for God. And all my education came after the fact with my own personal study.
Right.
So.
Right. Cool. So, your story, I mean, obviously, and I know a lot of people who are familiar with you would know, like, I brought you on to talk about agape, which has been a big topic of discussion the last couple months. You have a unique experience in the sense of most people who were on the staff side, like you were, started as students and then ended up just staying because where do you go? Like, what do you do after, you know, spending your teenage years like learning this environment? But your experience is different in the sense of you were actually went and got hired at Agape after college. So as an adult, what kind of opened that door to you working there? Like, how did they find out about you, or you find out about them, and the two of you kind of come together?
Great question. I was at college and I had nowhere I was going. It was my senior year, second semester. I know where I was going. And of course those wheelhouse start running. I don't want to work True Green and lawn care the rest of my life.
Was your original goal pastoring or something at college?
No.
Okay.
Not at all. Okay. My original goal was I wanted to be a youth worker, a youth minister. Okay. So I got my degree was in youth ministry, youth counseling, youth ministry. So I'm thinking, where can I go that's going to help teenagers out? Well, we got this guy, Rich Kazak, who was the president at the time of the school, of Agape Boarding School. He came to the college and he gets up in front of the whole student body and says, hey, we're looking for staff members to help troubled teenage boys get their life on track. And of course, I'm thinking, wow, dream job. All right, this would be great. And that's what went through my mind. I'm like, man, so what I want to do, help teens get their life on track. And man, I'm like, oh, then this is great. So man, chapel was over. They had a meeting room and I got up and I booked out the door. I'm like, man, I got to meet this guy. Man, I got to get in on this thing. So I meet him. We have a discussion about Agape and he asked what my heart is. I told him what my major was and what my desire was. And we agreed that it might be a good thing for me to come down and check out the school for a week. So for spring break, my senior year, instead of going home to my family, I went down to Agape for a weekend. And what I saw, like, wow, this is awesome. Of course, you didn't know the behind the scenes stuff yet. You don't see how things work. They paint a good picture. They're trying to get new staff members and they need new staff members. So man, you're meeting these boys and they're, of course, all talking positive about the school to me. And come to find out, they have to. You know, they can't talk negative about the school to people. I didn't know that at the time. There wasn't really any big incidents when I was there. When I was there for the week working as a prospective staff member, there were no fights, no brawls, no one getting body slammed, no one going to the intake room, none of that kind of stuff when I was there. So there was really no red flags except for, oh, man, this is great. I'm here. Mm-hmm. I'd love to come down. You know, I had a good relationship. I started fostering a good relationship with Kathy Clemenson and Jim Clemenson. I started fostering a good relationship with them, met with them. And Kathy really, really liked me, And I can talk about more in that in later and how that relationship ended up changing for the worse. And I decided this is what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And I met with Rich Kazak at the end of my week. And he says, so what do you think? I said, this is amazing. I would love this. He says, really? And that shocked him. Because I guess not most people don't give him that response. And I came to find out most people don't give him that response after I saw more prospective staff members coming and going while I was working there. And I said, I'd love to. So if you guys would have me, I'd love to come down here and work. And that's how I ended up getting hired. A couple months later, May 4th, 2012, I was there for my first day.
Hmm. Wow. So. And did anything change that first day or what was that honeymoon period where you were like, oh, this is exactly what I thought. This is kind of the picturesque brochure version of this place.
It was probably about 3 months. Okay. You know, you're learning, you're getting the little training that they did do. And I went there and I was engaged to my wife. We weren't married yet. Hmm. So I was living in the single staff dorms with a staff member named Justin Rarick and Nathan Comstock, who was a blue shirt there, who was an intern at the time for a summer just to get some college credit. And go ahead.
Yeah, just before you move on, what you said, what little training, like what training was there? Like what for staff members, like what training did you get before being able to like really dive in and start working?
Very little. It was more on the side of daily schedules. You always got to be watching. They always say the phrase, watch the boys. And,
so it's more learning the program than learning like techniques for, you know, de-escalating things or like CPR type stuff or basic.
Okay. Correct. Yeah. No, I did not have CPR at the time. I did end up becoming a medic while on staff.
Okay.
An EMT medic. And that was after talking to the leadership and saying, hey, I'd love to get involved in this side. The school actually gave me paid time off to go take medic classes. But that didn't happen at the start, of course.
Okay.
So it was very little training. And I'll be honest, I'm not trying to, you know, toot my own horn or pat myself on the back at all. I didn't need much help in de-escalating situations. It's always been a strong suit of mine. And which really set me and a couple other staff members apart from the main group of staff members who just escalated situations. I was one of the few that they used to de-escalate angry students because it's never really been hard on me. But as a normal training, they didn't really do that. At the start, they implemented something later called nonviolent crisis intervention, which is something they use in public schools, something that they use in juvenile facilities. And I'm all for that. I thought it was great. Mm-hmm. You know, instead of the old JMCT restraint or however you say it, instead of body slamming someone and restraining, it was more of just painlessly immobilizing the student with their arm so they couldn't swing. And it was one staff member on the arm, one staff member on another arm, and it was just so they couldn't fight. And no pain, no body slamming. I said the juvenile detention centers use it.
Hmm.
But the problem is we got trained in it, we all got licensed in it, but we never ever used it.
Right.
So it people still did the old restraints.
Hmm.
So, but yeah, that was to answer the question about training.
Sure. Okay, so so kind of moving on into that 3 month period, like what was the first thing? And I have to assume too, especially given the nature of where you're at, you know, and dealing with at that point, you're thinking everybody there is coming from these pretty crazy backgrounds. And I know from talking with people, there were people at Agape who were former gang members, all the way down to people who their parents were just really strict and they had done something stupid, like really, really meaningless and got sent here. So there was a very broad range of people. So I have to assume when you do start seeing a couple things like a violent outburst or something like that, I would assume, because this is how I would be, I got to assume you would justify it as like, oh, well, look at the type of people we're working with. You're going to have these kind of situations come up. At what point did you actually like recognize like, hey, something's a little bit off here. Like this isn't just a weird side effect of the type of work we're doing. This is actually kind of strange, this one incident. Or was it 100%. A couple different incidents that happened?
It was more over time. It was over time that took place. Of course, you're there. You see kids getting restrained every once in a while. And it didn't happen a whole lot my first couple months there, I'll be honest. It more my second and third year, there were a lot more. And that was just based upon the type of students we were getting in or different students. Some students, sometimes we had a student body that caused more problems as opposed to others.
Right.
But my first couple months, it wasn't a whole lot. And you're right. It's easy to justify it in your mind. You know, these kids who are, you know, gang members, and you lump them all into that circle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And no matter what they did, they're all gang members, drug pushers, alcohol abusers. And no matter what they did. And then you had some kids who were there for literally not making their bed. We had one kid that he didn't make his bed enough times. So he got sent to Agape. Mm-hmm. And so now we're lumping this guy who did practically nothing into the category with the gang members. We have one kid right now who's a Southern gospel singer named Caleb Kelly. Well, he seems more country now, but that kid caused no problems at all. Mm-hmm. He just kind of rebelled a little bit against his family at home. And I got really close to this kid when he was there. He caused zero problems the whole time he was there. And not because he was just playing the system, because he wasn't a bad kid.
Yeah.
He was worse than me he was way better than me as a teenager.
Right.
And this kid just got sent there because his music style was not as good as his parents, or maybe he talked back one too many times to his dad, and he gets there. So, and when I started seeing a lot of that, I started putting some pieces together. But what really got to me was when I started seeing some staff members, more of the gruff, angry ones, you know, they would always think the good cop, bad cop mentality. Mm. And I'm on the good cop side. And there are some people who were on the bad cop side. But what I would see is these staff members yelling at these kids in their face, and these kids not being allowed to respond or not being allowed to be frustrated. They just had to take it. And if they didn't take it, or they got angry, then they got sent to the intake room. I'm talking about staff members who are grown adults who should know better, getting angry at these teenagers, complete angry, screaming at them. And then it's my job to de-escalate the teenager.
Right.
You know, the teenager, you know, I have 1 Corinthians 13 open, and I see, you know, 13:4, charity suffereth long and is kind. Chariot envy and not chariot vaunted itself. It's not puffed up. It does not behave itself unseemly. And when I was quoted by the Kansas City Star as by saying that these actions are not loving actions, this is what I'm talking about. Mm. They had staff was puffed up, could never admit this. They could never admit they were wrong. And they had no patience.
Yeah.
Agape prides itself on agape love, but there was no agape love because they're in violation of 1 Corinthians 13.
Sure.
So,
yeah.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, what would you say the breakdown is of, like, the good cop and bad? I mean, I think that's interesting. Like, did you feel like it was kind of split down the middle staff-wise? Like, there was half were really earnestly trying to, you know, be helpful and actually make a difference versus, you know, I say this about every situation where you're in a authoritative position like this, whether it's pastoring, whether it's a police officer, military, anything where you have a high amount of authority. You know, you either have one of two people. You have the people that are genuinely, like, they just feel like they're born to help and they want to protect and serve kind of thing. And then you also have a lot of people who love the chance to stomp on somebody, you know, like there's really,
you're right.
You know, there's always a risk of that person coming in. So at Agape, would you say that, like, there was two or three that were, like, just really aggressive and bad and the rest were pretty good? Or would you say it was kind of split? Like, what was kind of the breakdown there?
You had some staff that were really good. You know, if I could show you my messages and the students give me names of the good staff members. And but there were some that weren't. But then there were some that didn't care either way.
Yeah.
They didn't fit in any category. I wish the Kansas City Star included this quote. I tell this to everybody I give interviews to or talk to about Agape. You know, Agape really greatly misquoted me in their response. If you look at the response and read the response, that their quote that I said, if you look at the Kansas Star article, I never said that quote. It was completely opposite. They said that I said that they faked that they love these students. And I never said that. I really believe a lot. I believe majority of the staff members genuinely care, majority, not all, genuinely care about the outcomes of the students. They are just grossly underqualified to deal with them. I had a message with from another staff member. I'm not going to give people's names just today. And they said, who do you think that you are? You know, you never had teenagers. You know, we raised teenagers and we're dealing with them. Well, of course we're qualified. Raising teenagers of your own does not qualify you from helping troubled teenagers. That requires education. That requires a different mindset. That requires licensures and studying and dealing with these teens on a more, on a different level than just yelling at them and forcing them to behave. I'm a pastor. I see the importance of scripture memorization. I see the importance of all that. But when you have a Muslim kid who's being forced to learn scripture, it's making him more angry as opposed to helping him.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a lot there. I think unqualified is a that's a situation that you see in a lot of these homes. When you start looking, I know Heal-Online, they have a lot of information on a bunch of different homes. And when you almost any show I've had, I look it up just to get a basic perfunctory kind of look at like the names of staff and like the part that's always shocking is they have a section for qualifications and it's often none. I think Agape, I did that live with someone. I don't think we ever released the episode, but we did. I was like none all the way down the list, and people in positions where they should have some kind of crisis counseling training. They should have some kind of trauma therapy background. They should have the ability to, you know, to talk in these situations because, I mean, let's be real too. I mean, like you said, raising a teenager where you know them, you're creating the environment is so different than taking someone at the point someone's in a gang. It's clear that they probably have experienced some kind of severe trauma or there's some mental issue there that's creating 100%. that longing for that. So, yeah, I mean, so the way of dealing with things, it seems like was you had the people that were just a little bit calmer and less aggressive. And then you had the people who were extremely aggressive and I guess forceful is the right word. Is that the right word to?
Oh yeah. Forceful and controlling. Definitely.
Okay.
Yeah. But they were even that way towards staff members.
Interesting.
There is a huge group of staff members right now who want to speak out, but they're still waiting on confirmation that the NDA is not legally valid, that most staff members are forced to sign. I can think of an individual, I can't say who it is, just for legal purposes, I don't want to get the guy in trouble, but he had a hurt leg and he was hurting really bad, and messed it up and hurt knee. And the staff member in charge of him made him, one of the more controlling ones, made him walk around the student body. You know, as a staff member who's hurting, who's injured, you're talking about an injured staff member who needs to go get help, especially if he got hurt on the job. But no, his mindset, the supervisor's mindset was, your pain can't be worse than my knee pain, so you need to get up and you need to walk around the student body and watch him. And that's the kind of stuff staff members went through as well. That's why you see a super high staff turnover rate at schools like that.
Yeah,
super high. I don't know. I know very, very few staff members from my time there who are still there because of being treated like that.
Right.
So,
you mentioned like obviously the intake room is that the same as the restraint room that Amanda messaged?
Yes.
Just different name. Okay.
Yes.
So how frequently was it a physical? I know you said the first few months it wasn't extremely physical. There wasn't a lot, but when you were there, like a year in, how frequent would you say like the more physical punishments were?
Well, the more, as I got more trust with other staff members and some of the more ones that dealt with the worst students, I ended up being one of those. I ended up being one of the staff members that dealt with the students who didn't want to do schoolwork. My job was to get these students who didn't want to do schoolwork to do geometry and algebra because I could do it. And that was my skill set. So when that started happening and I started seeing how some of those students were treated outside of school, you know, Browntown, which of course people hear the intake room. I want to say, so we call it the intake room or the padded room. That was, I didn't mind so much how they had the padded room laid out. I didn't like when they did the restraints, during the padded room, but I didn't mind so much their policy for padded room. as opposed to places like Circle of Hope and all these other Legacy Ranch and things like that, to where these kids were pretty much just thrown in isolation. That didn't happen at Agape. So I got to give them credit where credit is due. Whenever a kid was put in an intake room, they were always monitored in there with a staff member and another student. So there was never just one a student by themselves at all with any staff member. That just didn't happen. You were not to be alone with students at all, which I got to give them credit for that. You know, they did a lot of bad stuff. I give them credit where credit's due. So now when it got to the restraints, I think I was part of my first restraint. It must've been after about 5 or 6 months after I got married. When I got married was really the turning point in the relationship with me and Kathy Clemenson. Kathy Clemenson completely despised my wife, completely despised her.
Any specific reason? Like, or
when we first got there, the first week we're still moving everything. Well, when my wife first got there and they gave us a house, as opposed to me staying in a single dorm, I had a house now on campus. We were still packing things up. Kathy Clemenson said, "Hey, can you, I want your wife to work around the campus." Staff wives were forced unpaid labor on campus. Mm-hmm. Staff wives are required to work on campus for, I can't remember now. I think it's like 10 hours a week. I can't remember 100%, but I think it's like 10 hours a week that they are forced to work on campus without any pay. They do receive a gift in their husband's names at like $100 every month paid to their husband. So it is forced labor. Otherwise, as they say, your husband will be fired.
No.
And it's forced labor. So when my wife told her, no, I don't want to do that right now. I don't want to be a part of that. And that was like, you're standing up to me. And she ended up forcing her to do, based upon, hey, do you want to lose your house? Do you want to lose your paycheck? Do you want to lose your home? Do you want to lose everything you have and be homeless? And so my wife's like, oh, I don't want that. So then my wife started cleaning the nursery, helping in the kitchen and doing things like that. Though, albeit begrudgingly, she did get involved a little bit. But ever since that moment, my wife actually tried. My wife will tell you she tried. She vies for leadership's approval. My wife did. My wife would go into the office and just sit with Kathy Clemenson and just try to have a good relationship without any success. And she ended up giving up on that. Right before I got fired from the school. I was sitting across the desk from Kathy and Jim Clemenson. They call her ma'am there. I refuse to call her ma'am. I don't give her that respect. So people call her ma'am. I don't call her that. Kathy Clemenson and Jim Clemenson all admitted that they despised my wife. And 2 weeks later, we were fired. And I quote, not because of any lack of character or job performance on your part, but it was your wife isn't happy here. And you didn't sign the NDA form that we required you to sign. That was a turn. I don't even know if I answered your question at this point. I could talk for hours about Agape or a whole bunch of different things.
No.
So
you're fine. No. And I was just curious. I wanted to ask about that, but the way I had it set up, the restraint room's purpose was if a kid was really just like physically acting out, they would go there, right? Okay.
Not the only reason. Okay. If one of the administration staff, school admin, or dean of students, or just wasn't happy with the student, or just talked back, it'd be intake room, and they'd be sent back to the intake room. Could be for 2 hours, could be an hour, could be 3 or 4 days, and depending on the student.
Was for them to cool. Like, what was comply. The goal? Okay, so just basically to say, okay, I'm going to do what I was told to do, basically.
Correct. And it wasn't even to cool down. Some of the students that had to go back there weren't even angry. They just go to the intake room.
Okay. And then so the setup of it being padded, what was the point of that? I mean, it was just in case they were being more physical, or was it like, I'm just trying to, cause I've heard obviously the stories negatively about it where, it became more of like a rough them up room than a restraint room. But, the way it was supposed to be utilized was essentially to have them go there to basically comply. But it often with the staff got more aggressive than that, more physically aggressive.
Yes, yes. Depending on the staff members, of course. You know, there were some staff who were, like I said, who were great with the students, you know, and had no problem with the students. But yet, of course, you had some students who would be in the intake room and they would fight. I was sitting in the intake room one time and with a kid and with the other student that was next to me. And this kid, he just snapped and started beating the living daylights out of the other student in there. So I didn't try to restrain him myself. I think the student might have been stronger than me anyways. But I just separated the fight, and I'm lucky I didn't get attacked in that case. I just called for more staff. Staff came in and restrained him. I'm not talking about things, you know, that I understand that does happen. And there are some times where a student had to be restrained because he started trying to beat somebody up and for little reasons, or a student got mad. I remember one student got mad that he failed the test. So he gets up and starts running around the school, and he punches the soap dispensers off the wall, and starts punching holes in walls. And they had to take him in here. He's fighting back, and they had to put him on the ground for a restraint. I understand those type of situations.
Yeah, when it's for protection.
Exactly, for protections of other students.
Yeah,
even more on even then staff members, because you get 150 teenage boys together. They have a disagreement. How do boys deal with disagreements? They fight. Yeah. But yeah, it was for you know, restraining if need be. And that's pretty much why the floor was padded, just in case the student needed to go down to the ground. They didn't hit the floor and hit it hard to break a nose or break an arm or break a leg or whatever like that.
Sure. Got it. So, yeah, I mean, I know you said as you kind of were there more and you started seeing more, you know, you kind of got to know the inner workings a little bit. One thing that you mentioned was when you initially visited, there were a lot of people who weren't, who talked to you and were like praising the school, like students. And you kind of said now, you know, like they couldn't say anything negative or derogatory about the school. Can you talk a little bit about that and just when people would come visit, like how they kept things looking neat and clean when, you know, even when like government people would come in to check out the school, there's pretty strong kind of method to kind of keep all that stuff in check.
Of course. Government, anybody was not allowed to come in the school without a prior notice. They were not allowed in. They were able to come in with a appointed time. Even health inspectors couldn't just show up.
Because of the religious exemptions, right?
Correct. Okay. Correct. Now, that was then. I'm not sure what it is now. I don't think it has changed. I can't imagine it's changed yet. But, but you know, my wife worked in the kitchen for some time, and she would walk in the freezer room and the refrigerator, and she would see, you know, raw meat sit next to cooked meat that they were going to serve that night to the students, and raw chicken next to cooked chicken, things like that, that they would see clear health violations, very clear health violations, that when they found that health inspector were coming, they had students come in there and everything got cleaned up for when the inspector came and took a look, passed it off and left. Same thing with the ACE curriculum. You know, they the ACE inspectors would come in, and we'd make sure we have all our books and all our stuff ready to go for the inspection. And then after the inspection was done every year, we'd go back to the way we do things. When parents came in, there was a couple big parent visits every single year. I can't remember exactly how many, but the whole week before that, man, it was spring clean time, the whole facility. Mm-hmm. And that's what was done. So they would always straighten things up before big parent visits. And they would make sure things looked good, make sure things looked nice, make sure things looked clean. We were not allowed, the staff was not allowed to yell at students in front of parents.
Hmm.
Okay. And if students misbehaved while there were parents there, you know, it was automatic intake room, automatic, you know, so there's really a big appearance. If you notice in Agape's response, I'm not sure if you've read it or not yet, I'm sure you have. They said, of course, no current student or staff thinks negatively about the school. Well, of course, right. Of course, no current staff member. I take that. There could be a current staff member. You just don't know it. And number two, of course, no student's going to say anything about it. They don't want retribution.
Right.
They don't want anybody to, because all their letters were read beforehand, and they were sent back if they were negative. All their letters were read to them before they were read before they gave to the student. Sometimes the student didn't even get their own mail because something in it wasn't approved. Or something
right.
like that. So,
right. And just from the staff side, because I do want to try to understand the position of someone like you at the time who's there and seeing this. And, you know, I mean, obviously now looking back, you're thinking like, oh, we kind of just like just swept everything out that looked bad to keep up appearances. But, you know, one thing I always wrestle with, I think it's very rare that someone intentionally, I want to be careful how I say this. It's very rare that someone thinks they're doing the wrong thing. It's very rare that someone thinks that, you know, like it's very rare someone does somebody says, oh, I'm going to cover up that I, you know, can be abusive toward kids, or I'm trying to cover up that, you know, we handle things incorrectly. So in your mind as a staff member, obviously, like your goal was to try to help, you know, when it came time for those big spring cleaning moments, how did you rectify that? Like when you're sitting there going like, oh, we're trying to like do things differently than we normally do. Like, how did you handle that in your own mind and process kind of those, that dichotomy of how you acted when someone was there versus when they weren't?
Of course. And honestly, that was one of my least concerns when I was, my whole mindset was someone's coming to your house. What are you going to do before they come over?
Yeah.
Spring clean everything up. So I didn't think anything really of it, to be honest, at the time when I was there. It wasn't something that popped up in my mind or thought about. But you're right, you know, in regards to doing things, no one ever wants to admit they did things wrong. Something I want to point out before I forget, in regards to that same topic of what you just said, you know, if you go to Agape, they have detailed write-ups for everything that happened. But they would teach you as a staff member to do all the write-ups like you did nothing wrong. And so if you look at, so they say, well, we have records of all the restraints and all the riots and everything, but you won't have the fact that the staff member escalated the situation, or you won't have anything the staff member did wrong in that. That way the staff member doesn't get legally charged. So the write-ups are enhancedly biased against the student towards, and they would teach you to do your write-ups like that. I want to make sure I touch that.
That's a pretty big deal. When you're keeping records one-sided. That's super interesting. And I mean, the justification there was just like, if something wrong happens, we get shut down, or, you know, we're not able to help, or, you know, that kind of thing. Interesting. So did you have a sense near the end that you were getting near the end of your time there? Like, was your goal to be there long term? Or did you kind of in that, I mean, cause we had a very short like ministry stint, and it was very sudden, and we're like, oh, we thought things were fine and they obviously weren't. And then 2 weeks later we're scrambling. For you, was it kind of a slow process where you realized like, they're either going to fire me or I'm going to leave, or what was kind of the vibe there for the last year or so?
Yeah. No doubt. No doubt at all. The tension between me and the administration, I can't even say the lower administration, this is more the higher administration, kind of got very, very strained. A lot of it was due to my wife's relationship with Kathy, and that didn't help a whole lot. But I knew my time was coming there to an end. In fact, I was already putting my resume out at churches to leave. I wanted to have a place I was going. In fact, I got a call from my current church that I'm at now while I was on staff there saying, hey, would you want to check it out? And that was pretty much a couple weeks before I got fired. And I had another church in Arkansas I was looking at that I was in discussions with at the same time. So I knew my time there was coming to a close, and a lot of it was because of the NDA that I refused to sign, to where they brought it, they put it on our desks. My brother left a couple months before I did, might have been 6 or 7 months. My brother was on staff as well, my twin, and he signed it, and his wife signed it. And my wife and I refused to sign it. At a principle, I don't sign NDA. I don't sign NDAs at a principle. Then a couple months later, it was on my table. Hey, you have to sign this or you could lose your job. A couple months later, it was on my table again. You have to sign this or you'll lose your job. And so I knew that was kind of leading towards, okay, I'm not going to sign this NDA. So they're going to fire me. And now the day it happened, I didn't expect it. I take that back. When I heard the phrase, when I heard over the radio, Clydence report to Graves' office, I knew it was it. I knew I was done. I thought they're going to say, hey, this is your last week, but they said, this is your last day. You're going to be done after today. And they asked me to resign, which I refused. I wasn't going to resign. To their credit, they did pay me for a month of not working to help me move. Because I told him, listen, you're going to fire me. You don't pay us enough. Staff there gets paid below the poverty level. I want to make sure I point that out to people. Regular staff there gets paid below the poverty level. So when Agape writes that the staff gets paid little, you're right. They do get paid little. And it's on purpose. They want the staff members to be able to qualify for government assistance. They will tell you that. Well, they told the staff members. I'm not sure if they tell you that, but they told the staff members they want us to get paid little for government assistance. I said, hey, I got no money. I can't even leave if I wanted to. And so they did say, hey, we'll give you one more month pay to get you out of here. So I got to give them a woohoo. Yeah. Thank you for that. but when they asked me to resign and I refused to resign. So of course that means it was I was fired. So,
regarding the NDA thing, was that something they talked about when you were initially hired, or is it something they decided on? Was it something they were doing before you got there that you're aware of?
No, it was probably put in more towards my start of my second year,
which would be around what time period? This would be like
early 14, maybe early spring 2014.
Okay, gotcha. And did pretty much everybody else sign that you're aware of?
Yes, everyone else that I'm aware of signed it. It sat on my table. It sat on my table the entire time. I didn't sign it. And we still have it. I still have the copy of it unsigned, which is funny. Can I tell a funny story real quick?
Sure, yeah.
Okay, I think you'll enjoy this. In fact, the Kansas City Star reporter laughed her head off at this. I was on staff here at the church I'm currently at as the youth pastor. And of course, people call me Pastor James. And I get a phone call one day after I had put my initial review about Agape out on Yelp. I get a phone call one day and I answer the church phone and they say, hey, this is Pastor. And they say, oh, this is Pastor. Joe Grande from Agape Boarding School. Pastor Joe Grande from Agape Boarding School. And I'm like, hey, what's up? And they said, is James a member there? I'm like, they're talking to me. They thought they were talking to my pastor, but they're talking to me. And I'm like, yeah, James is a member here. Well, let me tell you what this guy's been doing. And starts telling me everything and then says, now I want you to know, and this is the big thing. I want to let you know that we do have the option of legally pursuing him and suing him because of the NDA that he signed. So then I said, well, let me give you a call back. I hung up. Then I called him back and said, well, yeah, I just talked to James. and he said he never signed it in the NDA. So, and said, he said, in fact, he still has that NDA. So they ended the conversation and I knew what they wanted me to be quiet. They were trying to threaten me to be quiet. So I wouldn't say anything negative about the school. So they still don't know that that was me on the phone. And if someone from the school listens to this,
now you know.
I know what their mindset is. I have friends and other staff members right now who have been threatened by the school to keep their mouth shut.
Have they ever pursued legal action or no? Or do you think it's all talk?
I don't know. You know, it could be all talk. I don't know. I'm expecting that if they do, it's going to be against me soon.
Right. No one's really rushing to find out if they are serious or not, I'm sure. When they get that call, it usually probably stops right there.
Usually. It didn't stop us. But I'm actually waiting for the Christian Law Association to give me a phone call is what I'm waiting for. And I'm excited for that phone call. If it does happen, I'm going to be like, wait, you're going to help a school sue a pastor, CLA. Is that what you're going to do? I'm actually waiting to see if that happens because I got my own issue with the CLA, and of course most people do, and to see and then to put them on blast on social media if they try to take that case against a pastor.
Right.
We'll see.
Well, I mean, stranger things have happened.
You're 100%
it wouldn't be the most egregious strange thing that they've been involved with. So
I don't think they'll have a case even if they tried, because libel cases are really hard to win to begin with, number one. But they can't disprove what I'm saying.
Right. Well, that's the reality of it. And that's where, and I've talked about this before, and like, it's probably dumb to even talk about it because I think it just invites things. But like, one thing I've just told a lot of people is, you know, it's very possible. When I started the show, you know, I told people like, it's very possible that at some point, some church that, you know, wants to spend the time is going to, you know, send something or, you know, send a letter, cease and desist and all. And that's something I had to come to terms with before I hit record on the first episode, like this might happen. But also, like you said, it's very hard to prove. And it's also another thing it's going to invite an investigation to verify whether the information is correct.
You're
and
right.
I feel very confident that the reason that I haven't gotten a call or a letter or anything like that is that the people who I'm talking about, even if, and of course, when you're doing 100 hours of a podcast, the chance of something being, I just did a correction for a video where a detail was incorrect or a timeline was off, even that's going to happen. But for a pastor to say, like, where there's some kind of wrongdoing or abuse happening, which everyone I've covered, I could find, there is something there. There's a truth there. You know, those pastors that run churches like that don't want to invite a full-on investigation to what they're doing to confirm which part of the abuse is accurate. And so, 100%. You know, and so I think just speaking to people, again, I'm not a lawyer, so if you do this and get sued, don't blame me. But you know, like with people, I'm just always like, if you know what you're saying is true, and you know, don't let someone scare you out of sharing your story. Because the chance, I mean, I've had a couple of people that have not come on the show who I've talked to, you know, beforehand, and they've just expressed concerns about that. I'm just like, I'm going to get sued before you get sued. So, you know,
if you're the one doing the broadcast,
right. You know what I mean? And I'm just like, you need to understand like the, and again, this is probably jinxing myself, but I'm like the fact that I haven't, and I'm now a year into this, I think speaks to a lot to the validity of the statements that are being made.
Yeah.
And also just beyond that, like, you know, again, I'm also just from another layer of this, I'm also basically reporting what people are sharing with me. So there's a lot of layers to this where like the amount of drama that would have to go through to try to do some basic lawsuit would be pretty insane. I'm not saying that there's someone who won't do it. And I actually asked a lawyer who I was talking to, and I said, so do you think I'll be sued over this? And he was like, oh, absolutely. He's like, it's just he's like, I don't know when. He's like, but at some point somebody's going to try doing something. And I was
why?
Like,
thank, you're never so controversial at all. None
right,
of your podcasts
right,
never controversial.
Right.
But again, loves you on social media.
Oh yeah. But I mean, but again, it's like, it's one of those things where like, you know, you have to take what you do know and you have to report the best you can with what you know. And I think the other side of that too, and I think you've been good about this just in this conversation, what I've seen you do is when you are wrong about a detail or when you could exaggerate and you hold back in that moment, you know, that's where I think there's an incredible amount of credibility just to people listening. And I think you're in the same boat as me. Like, I understand that's a possibility, but the message is important. So I'm going to keep sharing it. But I also think too, like, I think the credibility that comes with saying like, oh, hey, I said, yeah, you know, I just did this recently. I said that at this time period, the college knew this, but they didn't, you know? And so I corrected myself. And I think if you can show that intent to be truthful, I think that's going to get you a long way, but that's a big rabbit trail. Again, I'm not a lawyer, so don't start saying stuff and then, you know, call me and be like, hey,
Eric told me this.
But I think it's important. I think all of that stuff really matters. And I think like even you saying, you know, hey, to Agape's credit about this or about that,
yeah.
I think when you do say this is where it went too far, it gives a lot of credibility there. Mm-hmm. What a rabbit trail. But but yes, so what led to you kind of turning? So you got this pastoral job, you left, you're probably in the moment going like, thank goodness, you know, that was getting super weird and I'm glad that we're out. But at what point, you know, you're taking over a church, you know, obviously that's a pretty time consuming task when you first get there and never stops being a time consuming task. So what kind of flipped you back around to say like, I need to talk about this. Like, this is something that I need to be open about, my time at Agape.
That was, we never stopped that. The whole time, this whole past couple years, we've tried, I've talked to three reporters. I could not tell you the name of the newspapers for the life of me anymore. I wish I could remember their names, but I can't. Who wanted to start an investigation into Agape from the Missouri area, one from St. Louis, one from Kansas City, and one from somewhere else. I'm not sure if it's Kansas City Star or some other paper. I couldn't tell you that. And we gave them stories and it led nowhere. Okay, so we've been trying, and I multiple times I told the students on some different Agape students page, hey man, We got someone who wants to look into it. Let's go for it. Let's go for it. Let's go for it. And eventually around 2017, 2018, at the most recent time that happened, students would be like, this isn't going to happen. We're not getting any traction. Nothing's going to be done. And student interest and student thought, you know, even with this whole Kansas City Star article, I was like, hey guys, we got this going on. This is going to happen. And I just talked to a reporter and they were like, oh, okay. Okay. Well, we'll believe it when we see it, is what the whole mindset was. So we never really stopped. In fact, just this morning, I was on my phone, on my iPhone, and I had notes that was gonna if I needed them, I was gonna write. And so I just took my search bar and wrote notes from Agape, in my search bar, and I found something I had written, a huge thing of notes, the good and the bad thing of notes that I wrote in 2015. In May of 2015, just a couple months after I left, that I was really pushing out there. This is where the goods, this is the bad of Agape. These were things they did right, and these are the things they did wrong. So we never stopped, you know. So to answer your question, we're just happy it's starting to get traction now.
Yeah.
And we're just happy that the fight is going on. Like I told some other students just a couple days ago, some former students of mine, I said, hey, you know, the fight is still going on. There's stuff happening, but we're at least in a fight now. Yeah. Before we weren't even in the ring, and now we're in the ring.
Yeah.
So,
what do you think kind of pushed over the edge to where people started talking about it? Was it, you know, because I know Amanda got a ton of traction really early on.
Did.
Was that kind of what flipped the switch as far as like press interest? Do you feel like, or do you think it's just they had talked to you so many times that they decided to start doing a story? Like, what was kind of the
I think, I think Agape was right in one sense in their most recent article. The reporters who covered that the school in Florida, the one Hannah went to, I can't remember the name of
Lighthouse.
Lighthouse. Got a Pulitzer Prize for doing this article against this school, and it got shut down and all that. So I think that, and I want to be careful with what I say, I think some of the news reporters are trying to chase that Pulitzer Prize and trying to chase that next big story. Seeing what happened in Florida, that's when the conversation about Circle of Hope and the conversation about Agape started happening. So I can't say that there's not a tie-in there. I know Paris Hilton with Breaking Code Silence has been a real big push on it as well. Getting that celebrity face on the movement is huge. Mm-hmm. I've talked to her people, and I've given an hour-long interview with her people, I wasn't able to be at Agape last week, and I wish I could have been.
Yeah.
I had a funeral I had to perform. So, I think that's what really pushed the fight to the next level. But hey, you know, I don't know what their news people's perspective was. All I know is they wrote the article. It got before the Missouri House. They just released that the Missouri Attorney General is looking into Circle of Hope. They just announced that yesterday, which is a huge win. And the governor of Missouri wants something to be done about this. So what you see now, because this article, no matter their motives behind writing the article, is you see actual traction being done. And you see really what's been encouraging is a bipartisan effort to get something done in the state of Missouri. So we know something's going to be done. And now it's just a question of how far are they going to go in their restrictions and in their legislation.
Right. And this is important too. And I'm actually glad that you just made that statement about, like, regardless of the intention of the reporters, because this is a conversation I've had. You know, I'm an outsider to the, you know, the troubled teen community. Amanda back in February or March kind of told me, because I only knew about Agape and I knew the PR version of Agape. And she was kind of like, well, there's like thousands of schools like this. And I was like, I had no idea. But that said, one thing that I've just noticed, and this is with, I would say with that, within the survivor community of the troubled teen industry, within survivors of the IFB, like who've experienced abuse, is a lot of times there can be these like pockets of, well, I don't want to associate with this big push because, you know, because it's coming from so-and-so who I think their intentions are this. And, you know, I saw this with the Paris Hilton thing a lot within the troubled teen community. And again, and this is not me saying, because I'll probably take some heat over this, I'm not saying that you're not entitled to your feeling about it. And again, I wouldn't even put myself in the same category. I understand I'm an outsider and I don't have any of the trauma associated with that world whatsoever. So I know that it's easier for me to talk about it, but you know, I'm not a Paris Hilton super fan. I mean, I've become one in the last 3 months. It's super funny, but I didn't care what Paris Hilton did. She was another celebrity that I just didn't follow. I mean, there's people, celebrities that I would be super psyched if, you know, they jumped on board with certain things. But the Paris Hilton thing, I got very excited because she used her platform to speak out about it. And yeah. I think there were a lot of people who got in the mode of, well, she's just, you know, whatever. I don't even think this stuff's true just based on my conversations. She's just using this to launch a rebrand. She's just doing that, all these things. And so I don't want to be associated. Why are we focused on Provo? Why are we doing this? And you know, the conversations that I've had, you know, I'm just like, who cares? Like at the end of the day, and again, I want to be careful how I say this, but like at the end of the day, even if she is, which again, I don't think, I mean, she obviously listened to every episode, but you know, if she was to listen to this, I don't believe that's true. I think that she legitimately experienced pretty traumatic stuff and
of course,
now is speaking out about it. I think that's where it's at. But even if I applied the most cynical frame to all of it and said she's exaggerating, she wants attention, blah, 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 all the stuff that people are throwing out even beyond that community and into just the mainstream media, at the end of the day, the platform is still there and still giving a boost to the story. And I would say the same thing with reporters, you know, there's a lot of times where I've talked with survivors of abuse within the IFB movement, like outside of the troubled teen world and church world. Well, the newspaper's just doing this because they want a big story. I'm like, but isn't that the point of sharing at all, is to get a big story out there? So who cares?
That's the point of investigative journalism. That's
right.
The point.
Right. Who cares if they're sharing to get their Pulitzer? Like, you're sharing to get your story out. Let the two work in
tandem. Yeah.
Yeah. In tandem. And so I just thought it was good you said that. And I think it is important. Like, you have to accept the platforms that come. And is it perfect? Like, do I wish that, you know, do I wish that I didn't need a BuzzFeed to get my story out? Do I wish that I had multi-million, you know, subscribers that were begging to hear more? Of course, obviously you want the biggest possible platform, but when those places,
you'll get there.
Yeah. When those places reach out to you, you've got to take those opportunities to share your story. And, I mean, I did do a 45-minute interview with BuzzFeed and they kind of stabbed me a little bit because they did a huge article, like a really big article, and I gave a ton of information that they used in the article, and they mentioned me, a podcast that discusses church abuse. And I was like, come on. I had literally called,
give me the name.
Yeah, I called two people. Because I with anything like that, I'm always I just keep it to myself because I don't want to ever jinx myself. I'm very superstitious about that. And I just think whenever you tell someone something big's going to happen, it never happens. So I had called my mom, and I had told my wife, and I had called one other person who I work with a lot. And I said, I'm not saying anything. I'm just telling you guys, BuzzFeed set up an interview with me. I said, and they're doing a huge article, and this is not BuzzFeed contributor. This is BuzzFeed. And then the article came out. I'm like, I did the first thing. I just scrolled through. It's like opening a birthday card and looking for money. And I scrolled through. I'm like,
I did. The
I don't
City
see it. I was like, I don't see it. So I got to just read the whole thing. Maybe they just interlaced it throughout. And then I read it and I got to the line, a podcast. And the podcast was a little link that went out to my URL. And I was like, that's not what I expected. But
I thought the same thing with the Kansas City article. You know, the quotes they put in there weren't the big ones that I personally wanted to be in there, you know? And I was like, and then they went to it. And I'll be honest, I was so happy how Kansas Star did it. I was so happy because they put it right on the front page. But before they posted, I'm like, they are putting it out the weekend of the contested election. What in the world? Right. I'm thinking we're going to be a blip on the back page. But then I saw they put it on the front page. I was really happy about that. And I was really happy how they did the article on there. But
yeah, no, they did an amazing job with it. Yeah,
amazing.
It was really good. So just kind of, you know, looking to the future. I mean, obviously your focus is primarily Agape because that's kind of where you're at. What's your view on like the industry? Like there's a lot of talk about the troubled teen industry, and a lot of that has come from obviously the Paris Hilton doc is addressing, you know, now starting to go broad. Breaking Code Silence is doing that. Amanda, Hannah's work with her, her stuff. It's addressing the industry as a whole. Obviously you still have a lot of that desire to help, you know, younger people, to help teens who are, you know, quote unquote troubled. I know there's a lot of baggage with that title, but like they're troubled teens. Do you think that the industry itself is just kind of fundamentally flawed and needs to be done away with? Or do you think there just needs to be a sweeping reform within these homes? Like what's your kind of goal, I guess, in this kind of advocacy?
I would say both. You know, I think some schools need to be shut down. Mm-hmm. But I would be happy with sweeping reform, government legislative reform. When I talk to people about Agape, you know, I understand closing the school down is not going to be easy. Circle of Hope was way worse than Agape. I'll say that.
Yeah.
You know, from what I've read about Circle of Hope, it was way worse. I don't think that Agape is going to be shut down for those type of things. But Agape and schools of the like, they need to have state legislation to make sure their kids, their residents are being properly taken care of. This isn't a juvenile detention home at all. This isn't jail. It is a private funded school. And you need to make sure that these kids have proper education, because that's the state's responsibility to do, to make sure kids have proper education. You need to make sure that these kids are not being hurt, abused. They got to make sure that these kids are eating properly. If this is where they're going to be, are they eating properly? When they get sick, are they getting proper medical care? Do they have staff that should not be working with children based upon, you know, a false bad background check? Do they have some staff who have questionable backgrounds? Mm. Who and are the staff licensed to be able to deal with teenagers?
Right.
These staff really have college educations to deal with youth.
Yeah.
A lot of them are retired pastors or former pastors or someone who just needed somewhere to go and with no desire to work with youth, they just ended up there.
Yeah.
And while they may love the boys, do they know how to take care of troubled teenage boys?
It doesn't matter if you're well-intentioned. Yeah.
Intentions don't matter.
Yeah.
Intentions don't matter at all. Right. That's a conversation I've had with Hannah all the time. You know, while people may have good intentions, intentions don't matter if the job is done poorly.
Right. Yeah. 100%. And I guess just one last thing I want to ask, since you are currently a pastor, and you know, one of the big pushbacks with too much government oversight is, you know, will it affect our liberty to do, you know, A, B, or C within these homes, to, you know, do Bible memorization, to teach Bible classes? Do you think there is a place for a religious exemption within these homes, or is it something where you think that religious exemption is more often than not a license to, you know, to do whatever you want? It's kind of the Wild Wild West situation in a lot of places. Mm-hmm.
I really believe that they can have legislation that lets the school have their religious liberty, which I'm 100% for, you know, without sacrificing proper care. You know, I'll be honest, I don't believe, you know, making sure kids aren't being abused classifies as government overreach.
Right.
That's a state making sure its citizens are kept safe. It says her minors are kept safe. You know, you have a public school, and here's some of these abuses going down in a public school. What would happen to that public school? They would get in trouble. People would be arrested.
Right.
But this is a private school, so they get a religious exemption because, oh, they're allowed to slam kids, or they're allowed to beat up kids, or they're allowed to get mad. You're in a public school and you have a kid that's getting yelled in the face by a teacher. That teacher is going to get some heat, not at Agape. Right. And like I said, we didn't even touch ACE, that curriculum right there, and and how horrible that.
And I'm sure most people, or I'd say a good majority of our listeners who are from the IFB are very familiar with ACE. I dodged that bullet and actually got a really, I mean, I comparatively, I feel like I got a pretty good education. But yeah, ACE is a mess unto itself.
Fun fact, my grandfather's brother-in-law was the vice president of ACE.
No way.
Fun fact. So I didn't really know him too well at all. So it's not like but I found that out when I started working at Agape and told my grandpa, oh, there's an ACE. Oh, really? That's what my, not brother-in-law, sorry, cousin's husband was the vice president of ACE.
Yeah. That's super weird. Yeah. No, I mean, ACE is, it's its own mess. And I know guys that took that who literally struggle with like spelling, like grammar, like just basic education stuff, because it's not, I mean, it's literally just do it yourself school. And school is not, I mean, people debate even if like the traditional school classroom is helpful, but like sitting a kid down, I know me, like if I had done ACE, I would have bombed out of I would still be in high school now.
Yeah, me too. Yeah.
I
did PACES. I did PACES when I was at Agape. I did some of them just to, that's how I learned trig. That's how I had to teach myself trigonometry so I could teach kids trigonometry.
So very qualified. No, awesome. So yeah. I know you mentioned beforehand, I do want to just bring it up, but you'd mentioned beforehand you're working on a project to kind of share your story in like a longer format. Can you just talk a little bit about what you and your wife are working on and kind of when we can expect to maybe see some of that?
Of course. My wife and I are working on a new project. We don't have a title for it yet, but it's going to be a book about our time at Agape. And we are trying to be very, very careful with staff and student privacy. We're not using names. We're using false names for this, but we're going to tell our story of the things we saw, stuff we experienced. And my wife's going to tell it from her side of perspective. And I'm going to be in touch with some former students as well to write little excerpts of it as well. So stuff that they went through, especially the ones that did go through abuses, that did go through traumas. You know, I want to get their insert in here, you know, where I write it from my perspective and then the student gives it from their perspective. That way we get the full story of what happened. But yeah, it's going to be a book format. I am debating on releasing it chapter by chapter on some author site and until the project is complete, and then releasing it in a hard format. That because I know we have traction right now with Agape and with the schools alike. Right. Do I want to wait 6 months to a year before something comes out, or can we start putting out the story now?
Right.
But the introduction's done. The first couple of chapters is done. My wife is working on the editing of them. And hopefully we will have it out at least in part pretty soon, within the next couple weeks.
Right.
So, and of course, this is the first time we're announcing it anywhere. I haven't put it on any platform.
It's an exclusive.
I have not told anybody about exclusive.
The Pulitzer is in my grasp. So, but no, that's awesome. Well, thank you so much for sharing that. And I definitely look forward to that. And I mean, now you're a TikTok superstar, so, you know, your sales are going to be pretty insane.
Go through the roof. That's right.
Well, thanks so much for taking some time, to kind of sit down and talk about this. And obviously, you know, once the book's out, I'd love to chat some more about it, I'm looking forward to seeing what happens. And obviously there's some big stuff. I mean, Missouri, there's some huge stuff happening with, some of the legislation. So I'd actually reached out to, I'm blanking on her name. She did a pre-recorded speech for the event. But I'm trying to get her on to talk more of the legal side of everything. But it's a lot happening, a lot moving, and look forward to keeping up and seeing what you guys are doing.
Yeah, praise the Lord.
Thank you for listening to the Preacher Boys podcast. If you appreciated the content on the show, please leave a review on iTunes, and don't forget to connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, or Twitter with the handle @PreacherBoysDoc. Additional information can always be found on PreacherBoysDoc.com.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.